Good day, and welcome to today's Improving Medication Management and Home Care conference call. This call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Sarah Butterfield from iPro. Please go ahead, Ms. Butterfield.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Welcome to this afternoon's sharing learning session sponsored by MassPro, the Quality Improvement Organization from Massachusetts, the Northeast Healthcare Foundation, the Quality Improvement Organization for Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, and iPro, the Quality Improvement Organization for New York. We have the unique opportunity this afternoon for the home health agencies in all five states to learn and share together as a community, as we're all striving to improve the improvement in oral medication management quality measure. Our presentation today is structured to provide you with an overview of the medication management models that have been successfully utilized in the home health care provider setting, and also with some discussion on methods that may be used in application to improving oral medication quality measure for your agency. We again have received an excellent response from agencies interested in today's presentation, and we certainly appreciate your time and commitment to participate and collaborate with us on improving this measure. Those of you who registered for today's presentation were forwarded via email a copy of the slides that will be referenced along with a program evaluation form. We know some of you did experience difficulty in opening up the slides and printing them, as we have followed up with a number of you to assist you in downloading the slides. And I just want to give you the website where we do have a copy of the slides and the materials for today's presentation posted. They are posted to the iPro website, and in case you do not have a copy of the slides in front of you, let me give you the link to where you can go to download those. It's https://providers.ipro.org/index/events/id.293. Again, that's providers.ipro.org/index/events/id.293. And that brings you directly to a section where you can download the material. Just as a reminder, the conference call is being taped to make it available to you for future review, and I'd ask that you contact your individual QIO for availability of the recorded session. Presently, your lines are muted. However, following the presentation, we're going to open the lines up for your questions, comments, and further discussion. We're very pleased to have as our expert speakers this afternoon Dr. Denise Fry, Project Director of the Medication Management Project for the Partners in Care Foundation in San Fernando, California, and Dr. Darren Triller, who's a pharmacist for the Healthcare Quality Improvement Department at iPro. And I'd just like to share with you a little more detail of our speakers' backgrounds and their experience. Dr. Fry has over 20 years' experience in home care and long-term care, including as a consultant pharmacist working directly with clinicians at the former Visiting Nurse Association of Los Angeles. She has developed and implemented several national multi-site demonstration projects in geriatric HIV/AIDS and hospice palliative home care. She has served as consultant pharmacist, project director for the VNA of Los Angeles, and field consultant for JCO, Home Health Program. Dr. Fry has presented at local, state, and national home care and pharmacy associations on a variety of topics. She is committed to improving medication management and advancing the practice of consultant pharmacists in home health and long-term care. Dr. Fry is also an adjunct faculty at the University of Southern California School of Pharmacy, precepting the geriatrics rotation, and she has also been involved in the editing process for a recently published special medication management issue of Home Health Services Quarterly, Improving Medication Management, Issues and Solutions. And that's been published by Haworth Press. Dr. Triller received his bachelor's degree in pharmacy from the Albany College of Pharmacy in 1989 and received his Doctor of Pharmacy degree from Albany College of Pharmacy in 1998, graduating magna cum laude. Since completing a two-year fellowship in home health care in 2000, he served as a tenure-track assistant professor at Albany College of Pharmacy and in the Department of Pharmacy Practice. While he maintains an appointment as adjunct associate professor at the college, he recently joined iPro's Healthcare Quality Improvement Program full-time, and he will be contributing to efforts relating to improvements in the Medicare drug benefit, as well as our own home care initiatives. He has a number of professional publications relating to adverse drug events, and medication management, and he will continue to serve as a resource to agencies collaborating on IPRO initiatives. And we're very honored to have both of you with us today to share your expertise. And I'm going to turn the call now over to Dr. Triller.
All right. Thank you very much, Sarah. It's exciting to be in on this. We've got people from all over the Northeast and at least one person dialing in from sunny California. So let's get started. What we'd like to do today is to basically cover a few bases. We want to make sure, starting out, that we can develop in you an appreciation for the prevalence and severity of medication-related problems. I'm sure in your day-to-day patient care activities, you're aware that there are a lot of problems encountered by your patients, but we're going to try and give you some information to really drive home the point of how important this is and why we're trying to improve actual patient care, not just seek to change some indicator on a form somewhere. We're going to spend quite a bit of time reviewing some large-scale medication management programs. Dr. Fry will touch on one in great detail that have been developed throughout the country to give you some ideas of what can be done. And I also want to spend some time going over some recent changes in the healthcare environment that I think have really primed things for home healthcare agencies to be able to interact more effectively with health systems, hospitals, and healthcare providers, whereas over the last few years that may not have been the case. And we really want you to come away with practical ideas for improving medication management. It's no help for an organization like a QIO to put forth some pie-in-the-sky ideas and things you should shoot for. I've spent the last 8 years working very closely with local home care agencies, so I know exactly what you are facing, resource limitations, and the challenges with your patients. So we really want you to come away with some practical things that you can do at your own level. So let's move forward a little bit. And I keep hitting the wrong button. I apologize. All right. Dr. Fry inserted this slide to remind me and to remind you that prescription drugs are the mainstay of treatment, that our drugs are doing wonderful things. They are keeping people at home. They are making people well. They're keeping people well longer. And I sometimes lose sight of that myself as I discuss the data showing how harmful medications can be. So we need to realize, starting out, that medications are wonderful things. They are allowing our patients to live longer, to live healthier lives. But we're going to spend some time going over some of the limitations and some of the problems we're running into. These are some of the statistics that you might be familiar with already. Just to get us all on the same page, medication errors have been cited as the fifth leading cause of death for older adults. And some reports have estimated that there may be as many as 7,000 deaths per year just due to adverse drug events alone. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit more detail later on. There is more and more data coming out in the medical literature showing how frequent these adverse drug events happen, and you're probably seeing them on nearly a daily basis in your own practice setting. They're extremely costly. That is a bad thing. It costs approximately $120 billion for adverse drug events. One of the good things about them being so costly is now they're finally starting to get the attention they deserve. People who are responsible for paying health care bills are starting to realize that that the adverse effects and adverse events are contributing greatly to costs. So now that they're realizing the costs that are associated with these adverse outcomes, people are actually starting to be willing to do something about it. This is just some more data. You may be familiar with the Institute of Health's report to Errors Human, and they estimated that medical errors could actually be as high as the fifth leading cause of death in the United States, outpacing motor vehicle accidents, breast cancer, and dwarfing HIV and AIDS-related deaths. So those are conservative estimates on the impact of medical errors in the broadest sense. Some of this information is similar here. So the 7,000 deaths that they mention, I think, is actually a gross underestimate. If you look at the Institute of Health's report, much of their data came from inpatient settings. The estimate doesn't really include deaths and harm that are occurring in the outpatient setting. And you know as well as I, in those patient homes, there is no there's no system of tracking the errors that happen and reporting them onto the government. So that estimate, when they say that medical errors are one of the major killers in the U.S., that's only based on hospital data. So the causes of death or the number of deaths contributed by medication adverse events and errors may actually be much, much higher. And that's a little scary. Some of the good news is that many of the adverse events that we see have been shown to be preventable. There is a study that was published in JAMA by Gerwitz and colleagues in 2003, and they estimated that although adverse drug events were very common, they estimated that a full third were actually preventable. And when they looked at the most medically serious adverse drug events, nearly half of those are preventable. So the medication errors and adverse drug events are very common. The good news in that is that if we improve our health system, we may be able to prevent a lot of these adverse drug events from happening. So I'm going to advance to the next slide. Home care patients are at particularly high risk. There's a number of reasons for this. The demographics alone contribute substantially. Increasing age has been associated with adverse drug events, and the number of comorbid illnesses that your patients have put them at considerable risk for having an adverse drug event, and the fact that if they have an adverse drug event, it may be more serious. So if I have a, if I become drowsy from a medication that I take, I'm not going to fall and break my hip, whereas the home care agent, agency patient who's 80-year-old with five different diseases and some visual impairment has the same adverse effect, they are more likely to be harmed. The number of adverse drug events goes up considerably with the number of medications you are taking, and we all know that your home care patients are on a large number of medications. So they are really a unique population at extremely high risk of adverse drug events. And actually, these risk factors are the reason that drew me into practicing in the home care arena to begin with. I'd worked in the hospital settings and in the community pharmacy settings before and realized that these home care patients are a unique population that are at very high risk and in need of a lot more assistance. Other things that contribute to your patient's risk of adverse drug events is that they've had changes in their clinical conditions. And we all know that when things are changed, it increases the risk of problems happening. In the inpatient setting, when a patient transfers from one level of care to another, those of us that have worked in that setting realize there's opportunity for mistakes, miscommunication, and harm, and that is no different in the outpatient setting. And actually, it may be worse as patients transfer from a facility to an entirely different environment. So changes in level of medical care, changes in their conditions often result in changes in their medications. So adding, stopping, and otherwise changing medications increases the risk of harm. And the fact that we're providing care in such a fragmented setting in the outpatient arena actually puts the patients at much greater risk. So let's go on to the next slide. Just a little bit of data, again, from another study. 20% of the Medicare population has five or more chronic conditions, so that's very high. They see 14 physicians a year, fill 50 different prescriptions annually, and account for two-thirds of total Medicare spending. So just more information to drive home the point that your patients are at extremely high risk for adverse drug events. And we'll go on to the next slide. I apologize for this complicated slide. This is, if you're interested in visiting the paper, I gave the citation down below. What this data is, it's from a study we did with the Eddy Visiting Nurse Association in Troy, New York, where we looked at patients who came out of the hospitals and went either to self-care, to home health care, or to long-term care settings upon discharge from the hospital. And what we were doing is looking at the prevalence of different risk factors, which are in that risk characteristic column, to see if the home health care patients had similar risk characteristics to patients who are in long-term care settings. And the reason we did that is because we already know that patients in long-term care settings get standardized, mandated pharmaceutical care and drug evaluations, whereas our home care patients don't. And what we found is, without going into the numbers, is that home health care patients have either similar or higher rates of prevalence of various risk factors for adverse drug events, including the numbers of drugs they're on, the prevalence of cardiovascular drugs. So they are using more drugs and are more likely to use the most harmful drugs than patients in the self-care group and actually in higher rates than the long-term care facility groups. Again, driving home the point that the home health care patients are a unique group that really need a lot of medication attention. So going on to the next slide. Another piece of literature that was included in the Institute of Medicine report that I love showing with people to drive home again why home health patients need such attention is this one study by Phillips that was in The Lancet. And what they did is they looked at 10 years' worth of death certificates from 1983 to 1993. And what they were looking for was medication error as an actual cause of death. So they excluded suicide, they excluded poisonings and some of those other causes, and they narrowed it right down to medication errors as a cause of death. Overall, for the entire U.S., they saw about a 2.5-fold increase in medication error-related deaths. When you look at where they happened, this is the most startling statistic, is that the rate was pretty static in the inpatient setting. In the outpatient setting, it went up almost 9-fold in a 10-year period. And when we think about what happened in between 1983 and 1993, those of you in home care are aware that we started reimbursing hospitals with DRGs. We started sending people home earlier. The rise in home care went, you know, there was a huge increase in home care utilization. And basically, we sent patients into a setting where the medication utilization system is not the same as it is in the inpatient setting. And if they were to do this study again from 93 to 2003, I'd imagine it's still as bad or perhaps even worse as the number of drugs go up. So painting a grim picture, and I apologize for that, but I think it's important to have this basis as we discuss why we need to pursue this indicator. So moving on to the next slide. Okay, adverse events are likely in the highest risk patients. Just some more data. Studies evaluated adverse drug events in 30,000 Medicare patients, a large study, and actually this was done in Massachusetts, I believe. So these were Medicare HMO-managed patients in Massachusetts and New England. And what they found is that as they studied these patients, they found 1,523 adverse drug events that caused either unplanned doctor's visits, ER use, or death. And they found one for average of 20 patient years of evaluation. So one out of patient 20 years of care, a patient is going to have an adverse drug event that sends them to the ER, to the hospital, or perhaps kills them. And again, most of these, or a good portion of these, were actually preventable, especially the most serious ones. When you look at the data in that article, it startled me to see that the average patient in that study was taking 4 medications, slightly under 4, and they had 1 out of 20 patients have an adverse drug event in a given year. If your patients are on 12, we know the number of adverse drug events goes up, not in a linear manner, but an actual higher rate. So doubling the rate of drug use more than doubles your risk of adverse drug events. It makes me very scared about the number of adverse drug events that are happening in our home care patients that are on 12, 15, 20 medications, and we all know that they're out there. Going on to the next slide. So putting it all together, I apologize again that the data is a little grim, but I wanted to really draw everyone's attention to why this is so important. So adverse drug events are contributing to the death and hospitalization of a growing number of community-dwelling elderly. Your home care recipients are especially high risk for experiencing some events. A large portion of the events are preventable, so we're very optimistic that changing how we approach these patients can actually result in clinical improvement. But we really need to fix the health system that we have if we're going to realize these gains. So at this point, I think we can take a brief second, perhaps, and field any questions if there are any. And if there are not, we'll pass it over to Dr. Fry. Are there any questions from the various people in the field?
If you would like to ask a question at this time, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please be sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that's star 1 on your touch-tone telephone, and we'll pause for just a moment to give everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. And we'll take a question from Lorraine Mazzarani, Long Beach Medical Center. Please go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I was just interested, backing up on what you said about patients with four medications or less. Was the indication that those were at higher risk, or the statistics showed that those were more problematic than the ones that are polypharmacia?
No. The way the study was done, that number of four medications was the average number of medications that patients who they studied were on during the study. So they took a pool of the 30,000 patients that were enrolled in the various Medicare programs that they had access to the data, and the average patient in that study was on four medications. So there may have been patients with more. There were surely patients on less, but we know the average number of medications for your home care population is much higher, average of nine or perhaps more in the home care setting. So just comparing your general HMO managed care outpatient group to your home care population, the home care population is on far more medications on average. So my estimation is that they're at far greater risk of adverse drug events. The folks in the managed care study here were largely outpatients who were not receiving home care.
Oh, great. Thank you for clearing that.
Welcome.
And once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question at this time. And at this time, it appears we have no further questions from the phone audience.
Great. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm now going to pass it off to our correspondent in California.
Thank you, Darren. This is Denny Fry calling in from Los Angeles. And what I'm going to do now is review some medication management programs that have been developed in home health and home care. The first program that I'm going to talk about, actually the program I'm going to talk about is in three parts. Has been funded by Administration on Aging and also by the Hartford Foundation, so that's our commercial break there. I'm going to be talking about the Medication Management Intervention Program that I've worked on and that also Dr. Triller worked on as part of his activities at the Eddie VNA. Next slide, Darren. The clients that we looked at, the targeted client base of home health clients, were at two Medicare sites, Medicare home health agencies, the Visiting Nurse Association in Los Angeles and also the VNS in New York City. And our targeted base was home health, and then in the next phase of the study, it was dually eligible Medicaid waiver clients. And we were targeting these clients, as Darren went over before, because we really expected that this client base is at very high risk for medication problems, as he mentioned, due to multiple medical comorbidities and frail condition. And the bottom line of the reason we were doing these studies is that we thought that many of these elders do not know which drugs they're on and why, and we wanted to really assure that they are taking the right dose of medication, the right drug, and that it's correctly administered. So that's sort of an overview of the goal of the studies. Next slide, Darren, please. The medication management project rationale was we were really looking at a number of issues in doing these projects. We were looking at patient safety, medication errors, as Dr. Triller went over in very great detail and really excellently pointed out the very high risk for these Medicaid clients as well as Medicare home health clients. And then one of the rationales we were looking at that he touched on a bit is the Olmstead Act. And this act in the Medicaid waiver clients is that there's really an equity issue here, that pharmacist review is mandated for all skilled nursing facilities, and it's also mandated in ICF and adult day health care. But this type of review is not mandated in programs that assist the dually eligible, and it's also not something that's mandated in Medicare home health agencies. And we really wanted to take a look at this. I think, as Dr. Triller pointed out in the slide that he showed the prevalence of the risk characteristic, is that the home health patients also are very high risk, and we know that. So we thought that one of the rationales for doing these projects is really to take a look at pharmacist review and the necessity for it in the home care clients. Something that we were also thinking about in doing these projects, particularly the most recent project, is the Medicare Drug Act. As you all probably know, with implementing Part D, medication therapy management is a provision for high-risk seniors in the new Medicare Drug Act, and we wanted to see how this might impact also the home care client. Okay, Darren, next slide. So what I want to go over now is the medication management program and talk about the home health evidence-based origins of the program. This home health study is a study that was developed by Vanderbilt researchers as well as the Visiting Nurse Association, which is now Partners in Care Association, for whom I work, and the Visiting Nurse Services in New York City. This was a multi-phase study to look at the prevalence of medication errors in the home health setting, and I might mention that this is really the first large-scale program of this sort that was undertaken, and we were also looking to improve medication management among the beneficiaries receiving home health services. And in order to do that, we were going to conduct a randomized controlled trial. So we wanted to test the efficacy of a medication management model in home health agencies, and we also decided to use in that model a pharmacist-centered intervention to identify and resolve medication errors. I might mention that this study was funded in the 90s by the John A. Hartford Foundation, and as I mentioned, Vanderbilt University under Dr. Wayne Ray were the principal investigators. Okay, next slide. The results of the home health study were really very significant. In looking at the medication errors, the prevalence piece of the study, we found that almost 19% had medication errors using the Beers criteria, and 17% had medication errors looking at using the home health criteria, which were developed for the study. I'm going to talk about those criteria more in one of the upcoming slides because I think it's very important to explain the rationale of using this particular set of criteria. And then looking at both criteria, the Beers criteria and the home health criteria, the clients that were studied, which were about 6,700 clients, had up to 30% potential medication errors using both criteria. Just a point of clarification right now, it's sort of hard, you know, when I can't see the audience, but I'm hoping that most of you know what the Beers criteria are. But just to review, these are criteria that were developed for the long-term care setting by Mark Beers, and these are medications that are not really optimal when used in the elderly, and it could be that they're either a suboptimal treatment choice because there are better treatments available, or these are medications that might be good medications used in the general population, but in the elderly they carry more risk for side effects or adverse effects. So those are the Beers criteria. They're very commonly used. They're used a lot in the long-term care setting. They are mandated in the nursing home. Pharmacists have to review the beer using the Beers criteria when they do their pharmacist review. Then moving on to the second part of the study that we did in home health is in the randomized controlled trial, we found that medication use improved in 50% of the intervention patients compared to 38% of controls. This was the randomized controlled trial that looked at using the pharmacist-centered intervention, which I will discuss in a few minutes. So there was really a significant improvement in the home health clients using this type of intervention. We found that the improvement was greatest for therapeutic duplication and also for cardiovascular problems that were targeted. Therapeutic duplication, as you'll notice from the numbers on the screen, really there was quite a bit of improvement. So we think that this particular intervention is a really important one to target. A couple of the other interventions that we focused on, such as psychotropic drugs, did not have a particular improvement. There was not a statistically significant improvement, and I'll talk about those in a few minutes as well. Next slide, Darren. Okay, then the conclusion of this trial was that we found that medication errors can be identified using this process as well as resolved, and prescribing practices can be improved in this Medicare home health population. So this trial was conducted, as I mentioned, in two of the larger home health agencies across the country. And what we did then is we were able to get additional funding from Hartford Foundation to be able to disseminate the results of this important study and also to give some technical assistance to four other sites across the country. The Eddie V&A, where Darren Triller worked, was one of the sites, and actually Long Beach Medical Center, I think we have somebody on the phone from Long Beach, was another site, as well as a proprietary agency in West Virginia. And then we also looked at one of the other units of the VNS in New York, and we got some very interesting information from that technical assistance as well. Okay, Darren, do you want to go on to the next slide? So based on the evidence, what are the core features of an effective program like this? One of the really important features was the guidelines that were established by the expert panel. This was an expert panel that did include Mark Beers as well as a number of other practitioners across the country. And they were convened by Vanderbilt to put together some guidelines to guide this particular study. And I think it's really important to understand the thinking behind this group of people. And I apologize if you can hear my phone ringing in the background. It's stopped, luckily. These guidelines were established by the expert panel with a particular thinking. They really felt that it was important in order to get physician buy-in to this project to link signs and symptoms with particular medications. So they decided not to use the Beers criteria, even though Mark Beers was on the expert panel, because those guidelines have had some criticism, although they're very good and they've really helped to improve medication use in the nursing facilities. The panelists really felt that it was important to take a look at medication problems that could be solved in the home with the time that the nurse or other staff members had out in the home. And so they came up with these four problems: unnecessary therapeutic duplication, cardiovascular medication problems, and under this category it included hypertension, hypotension, or orthostatic changes, and then also looking at use of psychotropic drugs, which would be antidepressants, certain antidepressants, medications used for psychiatric conditions like Risperdal, and also looking at anti-anxiety medications and sleeping medications like benzodiazepines. And they decided to not just screen for those particular drugs, but also look at linking the use of these drugs with a reported recent fall and or confusion. So that was their thinking in looking at this category. And then also at the time, it was thought that looking at non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs in patients at high risk of peptic ulcer disease was really important to look at. Now, I want to mention, here, that in the number of years that we've been doing these studies, the use of NSAIDs has changed. That practice has changed. So whereas we looked at that in the home health study and found that there wasn't actually a significant difference in the randomized controlled trial. One of the things that we found was that there had been a change in practice during this time and that physicians were actually starting to prescribe differently during the study. However, I think it's still a good idea to take a look at these medications, the anti-inflammatory, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And I want to give you a story. My mother ended up in the emergency room last summer. She was taking low-dose aspirin, 325 milligrams of aspirin, for a heart condition. And as you probably know, that is within the recommended range. Either 81 milligrams to 325 are considered recommended. Well, my mother ended up in the emergency room with a GI bleed, and she wasn't on a particularly high dose of NSAIDs, but she did end up having problems. So I think it's still important to take a look at the NSAID drugs and think about your clients who are on these medications, that they still might be at high risk, although that practice has changed in this situation. So then these are the guidelines that were established by this expert panel. They also tried to look at warfarin use in the home, and when the first study was done in the mid-90s, they discarded this particular problem because they felt that it was not an easy thing to assess in a randomized controlled trial because we weren't really able to have access to labs on a consistent basis. However, that practice again has changed. So future guidelines you might want to include warfarin, and we are going to be talking about that in a few minutes. Next slide, Darren. So the other thing that we thought was a really core feature of an effective program was the use of a consultant pharmacist assisting, I put here the care management team, but assisting the home health team as well to assess and resolve potential medication problems. Both Darren and I are pharmacists. I have a lot of experience as a consultant pharmacist and at the time was working with the Visiting Nurse Association. So this is a model that we had established in our own practice, and we decided to study it and really try to elucidate how the consultant pharmacist can work with the home health team, and then for those of you who have waiver clients in your population, with your care management team. Next slide, Darren. And then the other thing that we thought was a core feature of an effective program is if it is at all possible to computerize a medication risk assessment, screening, and alert process, we really recommend that. In the original study that was done with Vanderbilt, we were able to computerize the medication risk assessment screening to identify clients and patients who had these particular medication problems. And so that is something, if you can do as an agency, that would really be a good idea. The implementation phase I want to go over so that you understand what the study and this phase of the study, the home health phase, and then also the next phase of the study. Staff conducted a medication assessment, as you always do. Staff would enter a list of medications into the computer database, and in the home health trial, the Vanderbilt group would assess the algorithm, would identify who was at risk for potential medication problems. I might add that the next phase of the study that we did was to implement this now into our care management programs here in California. We chose to do this in Medicaid waiver groups, and this is the phase that we're now using with our care management teams. So if possible, the software program then can analyze the data using the intervention's computerized algorithm for risk assessment. Then potential medication problems are identified. When this happens, the pharmacist reviews the medication regimen and consults with staff to develop a care plan. And the reason the pharmacist reviews the medication regimen is because it's really important to identify if this is just a potential problem or if the problem can confirm in. And sometimes the pharmacist can look at the medication regimen and see as well additional problems that might be impacting the patient's care plan. In the future, then, what we're hoping to do in our care management programs is to be able to alert care managers and even home health staff of potential problems right away. So if these computerized medication algorithms are used, right away there will be an alert to the care manager, to the home health team, and they will know that the person has potential therapeutic duplication and can implement the protocol right away. This then would allow, the idea here is to really try to empower staff, and then they can use the pharmacist for those complex clients. Next slide, Darren. Then the next step in the implementation phase is that the pharmacist or the home care staff contacts the physician. This would be to present the problem, to discuss the medication regimen, and to obtain follow-up orders. This implementation step was identified as a potential barrier, and this is something I know that IPRO has been working on materials that a number of the quality organizations have developed some materials about how to contact the physician. I think these are being rolled out. Maybe not all of you have gotten them already. But of course, the physician is such a key piece in this, and we have to make sure that the physician will be open to discussing the medication regimen and to making some changes that are recommended. Then the fourth step in this implementation phase would be that if the physician does make some changes, that the home care staff or the care management staff would assist the clients with any of the changes and also would look at adherence issues, following them up periodically. And then there would be a repeat of this procedure if there's a change in medications identified at the follow-up contact. What we found in our current study that we're doing that's funded by Administration on Aging, and this is looking at a care management population of duly eligible Medicaid waiver clients, we screened 615 clients recently. The demographics are here on the screen, so I'm just going to move ahead. But something I do want to point out is that the average number of medications in this group was almost 9. This actually was several medications higher than our home health study, where the medications were about 6 or 7, an average of 6 or 7. We found that there was really a higher medication problem prevalence in this group of clients. These are the Medicaid waiver clients that hopefully some of you have in your population as well. We found that almost 40% of our clients preliminarily had at least one medication problem. You'll see again that therapeutic duplication is the highest potential problem that we identified, with psychotropics being the next, which is not a surprise because these are clients that do have some depression and often have signs and symptoms of dementia. Next slide. Overall, we found that these results are double the prevalence of the home health study. So these are really significant to show that this population of the waiver clients is really more frail than the home health population. Next slide. We also thought that it was very interesting that our waiver clients had been in SNF ER hospital over the last year. And as I mentioned, they did have a higher amount of medications. And you'll notice these statistics here for falls, dizziness, and confusion. Really a high percentage of them had these signs and symptoms. And as I mentioned, these are the signs and symptoms that we were linking with the medications. Next slide. So one thing that we pulled away from this study is that the more the clients take, the more serious the problem. And I think that when Darren went over the slides earlier, you saw that it is a very serious problem when people had 4 medications. You can see in this study we're finding the clients with 9 or more medication have 2 times greater odds of medication-related problems than those with under 9 medications. And that the higher number of medications, again, is positively related to medication problems, therapeutic duplication, and inappropriate psychotropic medications, as well as the total number of med problems. So we thought that it would be important for you to take away some lessons. Some things that we learned in our program was that at the system level, we really think it's important to address practice standards in care management. Care management waiver programs right now do not have a particular practice standard for medication management like home health does. And so those of you who are dealing with waiver clients as well as home health clients in your agencies, you might want to take a look at the practice standards for the care management staff and your program. We also thought it's important to have a systematic approach, if at all possible, to computerize systems and also to look at MD communications. Next slide. Other lessons learned at the staff level, we found that the staff agree that improving medication management is important. However, we did find that this can present a challenge also because a lot of the waiver programs are social, medical, hybrid type of programs. And we found that with social workers, they really aren't really sure what is their scope of practice regarding medication management. What's my role? And we think that everybody does have a role in this. At the patient level, we also thought that we really may need to take a look at the guidelines and look at under-treatment, because we found data that suggests that in waiver clients, and probably this is true also for home care, for traditional Medicare-certified clients, that depression and pain may be under-treated, and this is an area that should be really taken a look at. We also found that empowering the client and caregivers is really a lesson that we might take forward, particularly as we want to try to get more cooperation from physicians. Also, cultural considerations really have a play here. And we wanted to take a look at adherence and assessment tools. Next slide. So putting it all together, our studies, the phases that we did in these studies, in these Medicare-certified home health agencies, the sites that we did technical assistance with, and now the care management agencies that we've been working with, we've been demonstrating that interventions like this can really improve outcomes in our client. And in reviewing the medical literature and networking with other agencies, we'll give all of you more ideas and we'll improve chances for success at individual agencies. And we really think that each agency can do a self-assessment to identify priority areas and to effectively allocate your resources. And we're going to be talking about that in slides that are coming up next. So Darren is now going to go on with the next section.
Before we do that, does anybody out in the field have any questions for Dr. Fry regarding her work?
And as a reminder, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question at this time. Star 1 on your telephone keypad, and we'll pause for just a moment. And we'll take a question from Cheryl Teigman, Revival Home Healthcare. Please go ahead.
Hi, Cheryl. Hi. Could you just please define for me specifically what you mean by therapeutic duplication?
That's a really good question. Therapeutic duplication in the algorithm that we use included trade generics. So that would be, for example, Lasix and furosemide. And it also looked at use of two medications within a therapeutic class. For example, we looked at Vicodin and Tylenol with codeine as an example, or we looked at Darvon and Vicodin. So if a client was taking both of those medications, that was considered a therapeutic duplication. Mm-hmm. Or if they were using NSAIDs, two different NSAIDs, for example, higher dose aspirin and Celebrex, that would be a therapeutic duplication that would flag.
Okay, but in some cases, despite speaking with a doctor, the doctor may feel it's needed. How would you define if it was indeed an adverse medication?
Well, what we did was we flagged the fact that they were therapeutic duplication and then clarified with the patient whether or not they were using both. If they were, then the physician was contacted to see if it was really necessary to have them on both. And in some cases, the physician would say, oh, no, I thought that the client understood or the patient understood not to take both. And in other cases, the physician would say, well, yes, because of this client's condition, I do want them to stay on both medications. So it was, in some cases, it is appropriate for a patient to be using both medications. For example, if they have severe pain, there might be a situation where they need to be on a Cox medication routinely, and then perhaps they're using PRN, something like Vicodin. Mm-hmm. And that's okay as long as we've gone through the process and documented that the physician is aware and wants them to be on that. Mm-hmm. But we really feel that it's important to evaluate the therapeutic duplication because sometimes it is a mistake, and the prescriber, or especially if there are multiple prescribers, they don't know that the patient is taking both medications. So do you see how that would work? And sometimes it might be appropriate to be on more than one medication, but at least then the physician knows and we ask them to reevaluate it periodically.
Okay, but just to be crystal clear, when you were aggregating your statistics, what you're addressing as adverse side effects with therapeutic duplication, you're referring to those that were confirmed with the MD to be therapeutic duplication.
Yes, we were only, the ones that screened in were ones that we had confirmed, and the and in some cases then when we contacted the physician, the physician would then say, no, it had to be, they have to be on those two. And so then we counted, we did not count that as an outcome.
Okay,
but
you.
We found really a very high incident of where physicians did not know that the patient was taking both medications and then did DSM one medication.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
We'll go next.
Good question.
We'll go next to Elaine Gartner, Visiting Nurse Association. Please go ahead.
Hi. I appreciate your presentation very much. I
Thank
had
you.
A couple of questions regarding on slide patient level. The last item says adherence assessment tools.
Yes.
I wondered if you could speak to that, as well as did you assess or standardize how staff conduct medication assessments? You could just talk about that a little bit, please.
Okay, so the first question was that to go back to the slide on adherence assessment tools.
Yes, the slide starts with patient level, and the last item says adherence assessment slash tools, and I wondered what that meant.
Yes, the adherence assessment tools is that we, in our study, we did not look particularly at adherence except as it was part of the, you know, an individual guideline. However, a lesson that we've learned from our recent study is that because we think adherence is such a major issue, that we are really recommending going forward that agencies look at their system of assessing adherence.
Okay.
And whether or not that's assessed on, I'm going to go back to the slide, I think, that you look at your individual assessment tools and see, are you asking questions about compliance or adherence on your assessments, and then periodically to make sure that your patients are taking their medication as they are supposed to be taking the medications. And then there are some tools that are being developed right now through our National Association of American Society of Consultant Pharmacists that I'm hoping to be able to make available to people on our website and through the American Society of Aging website. And these tools are really looking at screening people for high risk for adherence issues.
Okay.
So does that clarify the question?
Very much. Yes,
okay.
I appreciate that. And the other question had to do with how staff conduct assessments, if you examined that practice at all.
Yes, actually that's a big part of what we're doing now is that we found, particularly in the care management study, that there was such a wide variety of how what people are doing for medication management assessment. In some cases, people are just doing an inventory, and they're not really doing any kind of assessment of how their clients or their patients are taking their medications. So this would probably be one of the things I was talking about on an agency level with practice standards, is to take a look at how your the competencies of staff and to do some kind of a review on an agency level of orientation training for staff and your expectations for your agency to as to how staff should be doing medication management, what the expectations are for assessment and follow-up.
Okay.
Does that clarify
very well,
your question?
Yes. Thank you so much. Yes.
You're welcome.
And we'll take our next question from Catherine Curtis, Noble Visiting Nurse. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Rick Elmer with Kathy. How are you?
Hi.
I have just two questions. The first one is the consultant pharmacist terminology is new to me, and I was wondering if you can explain the difference between a pharmacist and a consultant pharmacist. And then the other thing that goes along those lines is, what are pharmacists' responsibility when they do fill a prescription? Are they aware of the full med list that a patient's on? I think I've been a little bit naive. I thought that that would be a responsibility of them, but what I'm hearing and as I read this presentation, it might not be.
Yes, I think that's a really good question. And Darren, if you want to jump in, too, because I think you were going to address the second question in some of the upcoming slides. The first question was regarding what is the difference between a pharmacist and a consultant pharmacist. A consultant pharmacist is a pharmacist whose practice is working generally with seniors in the community and or in the nursing home, although, you know, the nursing home is the community of the person who's living there. And consultant pharmacists are a category of pharmacists. They usually have a lot of geriatric training. They often have doctor of pharmacy degrees, and they the focus of their practice is in long-term care generally, as well as now they're branching out into home care and adult day health as well as assisted living settings. So this would be the group of consultant pharmacists, and it is a specific category of pharmacists. We have a national organization that is the association, it's the American Society of Consultant Pharmacists, and there is a website for that group. And if you're interested in identifying a consultant pharmacist in your area, the ASCP website has a listing of pharmacists who are across the country who are interested in working with the senior population. The second question then had to do with pharmacists who do dispensing and why aren't they dealing with some of these problems. And a lot of them are. A lot of the chain pharmacies, for example, or community pharmacists do have computerized programs that will screen for medications. But what we find with our home health clients and our waiver clients is because they receive fragmented care and go to in and out of the hospital in the emergency room, they often get medications from multiple prescribers. So that's part of the problem. It's not just one person dispensing the medication. And so the community pharmacist, we think, can be a big help. And going forward might be able to help even more, as Darren's going to mention to you. But they often... you know, they often do not have the complete picture and often don't know the clinical condition of the patients and clients that they serve.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that, Denny. I think it's got a lot to do with the fact that the system we are using in the outpatient setting is the same one that was in place when we were probably born or when our parents were being cared for. There is no connected system of med assessment and use in the outpatient setting, whereas the patients who were treated before in the inpatient setting had those checks and balances. So I think we need to see a big change in how we go forward. We're not going to be able to take any other questions right now, but what we're going to do is try and move forward, if that's okay, and we'll answer some questions later on at the end. I would invite everybody to stay longer. If you, for some reason you can't stay on the line, the entire program will be is being recorded. And if you have subsequent questions that go unanswered, please forward them to us, and we'd be happy to get answers to your own questions and actually share the answers with the rest of the group. So one other point I want to make before we move forward, and it relates to the last question, is the fact that you folks who are caring for patients in the home actually have information that the retail pharmacists don't have, the physicians in their offices don't have, and the patient, or the hospitals that are referring their patients don't have. You actually have something that they need, and we're going to touch on that as we go forward, if that's okay. So the next slide, if you had the graphic version before we scaled it down, there was a beautiful color picture of Saturn. And I know I've sat in on a number of these presentations before where we present an elaborate number of studies and things that people did that took years to develop and implement. And you're sitting there in your own agency saying, are they crazy? We can't do this. And I've been in a number of the agencies where resources are an issue, and time is always an issue, training, technology, all of those things. But what I'd like to get across to you in these last few minutes is the fact that things are actually changing, especially in that last bullet item, how we've tried to work with hospitals and payers and physicians before, but they don't really show much interest in working with the home care agency. And I think that that's actually, we're reaching a critical mass where there's a convergence of forces that are going to change, I think, how your home care agency is going to be perceived as you move forward. The one thing that made me think of this, there was going to be another picture here of a 10th planet that supposedly has just been identified. My second-grade daughter had to put together a one of those dioramas in a box of the solar system and memorize the planets in order, which we all had to do. And actually, now there's supposedly a 10th planet. So I'm thinking if the solar system could change, it's just possible that the healthcare system might change with it. So I'd like to take a few minutes and touch on what I came across as four points that I think are actually going to be very helpful to home care agencies as they reach out and try and get help in improving medication management. So those are changes in JACO accreditation standards, 100,000 Lives Project, HEDIS measures, and some changes in curriculum for colleges of pharmacy. And I'm going to go ahead and touch on those now individually. This is a direct quote from the JACO webpage, and there are some links here that will draw you directly to the full information. But I just put these here to give you some examples of the things that the hospitals right now who are JACO accredited are scrambling to deal with. Item 8A is to implement a process for obtaining and documenting a complete list of current medications upon admission. Oh my, who may have that list? The home care agencies. Many of your patients who are transferring to inpatient facilities are the patients that the hospitals need information on. Whereas before, the hospitals may have been unwilling or reluctant or a low priority dealing with home care agencies, you now have something they need. You can go to a JACO-accredited hospital that refers a lot of patients to you and say, let's talk. We have something you need, and could you please help us get better medication lists and better communication when you send the patients out the door to us? Not only on admission, but 8B is a complete list of patient medications communicated to the next provider of service. You are often the next provider of service for their highest-risk patients. So whereas before, the large tertiary care facility or the small JACO-accredited hospital really wasn't too interested in these things, right now you have something they need, and I believe they would be very interested in talking to you about improving medication management for your patients and theirs. The 100,000 Lives campaign, the Institute of Medicine report, To Air as Human, that I referred to before, estimated that there may be as many as 100,000 lives lost to adverse drug events. And the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, with the link here, has actually started a campaign to reduce medication and medical errors in inpatient settings. And these are just a couple snippets from some of their information that's available at their webpage, but the things they're talking about are preventing adverse drug events by implementing medication reconciliation. Reconciliation is the key word these days in inpatient settings. They want to know what medications the patients used to be on when they came in the hospital, before they came in the hospital. The other box here, which is interesting, is one of the recommendations is that they assign an executive person for this group at each hospital to be responsible. So you may actually be able to go on this web page, identify hospitals that are either JACO accredited or in this web page enrolled in this 100,000 Lives campaign, and identify hospitals and perhaps the individuals who you can contact whose responsibility it is to see these things happen. So you've got, I think, two good resources right here for helping you contact your local hospitals and to start working on these. And they have resources perhaps that you don't that can help you move along. But again, your transfers are their admissions. Their discharges are your admission. So you actually have a symbiotic relationship that you need to take care of with them. NCQA is an organization that puts together what we call HEDIS measures, and those are measures that the HMOs are assessed upon so that employers that purchase bulk health insurance for their employees can compare good health plans to bad health plans. And this is just a quick blurb from their draft one of their draft HEDIS measures for 2007, and lo and behold, it's inappropriate drug use, very similar to the terminology used in the Beers list. So here is another way that you can contact your plans that are referring lots of patients to say, we're talking your language now, we can help you meet this outcome if you are willing to deal with us and to help us with the services we're providing our patients.
Yes, and if you'll notice on that slide, that is what we did in our study. We linked these medications with a fall. And so we think it's so important if your assessment includes fall question, a good fall question, and your patients are on any of these identified medications, the tricyclic antidepressant, the benzodiazepine or antipsychotic, that those particular people be screened and the physician be asked, do they need to be on these medications at this dose? Because you might be able to prevent a future fall that could result in a hip fracture or other fracture.
Right. Physicians may be very unwilling to change medications in a stable patient, but as Dr. Fry said, if there's an event of any sort and you can bring it to the physician's attention in writing and perhaps link it to a drug that you know is already on the list of potentially inappropriate agents, it changes the atmosphere quite a bit, and the doctor may be a little bit more inclined to change the medications.
Yeah, and maybe not even de-seeing the medication completely. I think that's an important point. But in our older clients, these particular medications have very long half-lives, and it's very possible that the dose could be reevaluated to a lower maintenance dose.
Right, absolutely. So documenting at least that the physician's been alerted and that there was a discussion that's been had so that you're making decisions based on real information and not assumptions.
Yes, that's right.
The next one, this is interesting, and I don't know if this holds true for colleges of nursing, but there's been a huge number of, a large number of new colleges of pharmacy open, and many of the colleges are expanding their enrollment, colleges of pharmacy, and there's an organization that accredits the colleges of pharmacy, and on a regular basis they put out accreditation standards. And interestingly, the most recent accreditation standards that just came out in January or February of this year include these statements relating to experiential rotations that must be offered in these colleges of pharmacy. Traditional colleges of pharmacy will send students out on clinical clerkships at the tail end of the program, and now they're advocating and requiring that colleges develop early experiences and experiences throughout the curriculum. So the existing colleges of pharmacies in your neighborhood or in your areas now have to not only increase the number of rotations because of the number of students they have, but also to increase the types and flavors. And some of the things that are included in those required types of experiences are things that you do on a regular basis. The term public health appears there, responding to drug information inquiries, interacting with other healthcare professionals. All of these things are things that students have done on clerkship rotation with me and with Dr. Fry, and it turns out to be a very rewarding clerkship rotation at a home care agency for the students. And that's actually how we started with the home care program locally here in Albany, is starting out as a clerkship rotation for students. So if you have a college of pharmacy near you, going to the web page, and I'll go to the next slide, there are links here. One of them has a link to all of the colleges of pharmacy in the country, and another is the link to the accreditation standards. To contact the College of Pharmacy and say, we're interested in possibly having students come out, some of the colleges pay for clerkship rotations. Some give vouchers that can be used for continuing education. Some may provide you with technological resources, such as computer or Internet access to their library services. So this may be a way that you can start small and get a growing pharmacy presence by extending an offer to a college of pharmacy. And honestly, you don't actually have to have a college of pharmacy in your neighborhood either. We have catchment areas of students that cover, for our college, the entire state, some of the other states in the Northeast. If you have a student from your town, they may be home over the summer. Some of the colleges may allow them to get credit for working with you. So having students of pharmacy from your area might be helpful. So just another unique idea, I think, for pursuing getting some more resources to target this medication management issue. And I'm going to turn this off to Denny at this point.
Yes, so we thought that you might be asking yourself, so what can we as an agency do? So we wanted to present to you some ideas for what can you do by Tuesday. These would be some quick start ideas. We think that you can take some of the from our information today and take a look at what could be something that you could focus on that would be manageable for your agency. And we wanted to suggest that you start small with some of the ideas that we have put forward today. This doesn't necessarily have to be a huge initiative that each agency does right away, but starting small, looking at perhaps one staff member, one team, or one program, that you could be able to accomplish something in improving medication management in your agency pretty quickly. And Darren, do you want to go through these slides then?
Sure. Just a few ideas that came to our mind. Perhaps finding a local pharmacist from a chain or perhaps an independent pharmacy just to serve on a utilization review or a professional advisory committee. We've had faculty from the College of Pharmacy who have served on these committees locally, and that's what initially fostered the idea for the pharmacy school being involved. But getting a chain pharmacy or a local pharmacy to have someone come even quarterly to sit on your committees could get something going. Again, contacting the colleges of pharmacy, perhaps hiring a consultant. I know budgets are tight, but if you said, I've got a high-risk group of patients that I want to be at least evaluated quarterly, you might be able to hire a pharmacist to come in specifically for those services, and that's not going to break the budget. It's not the same as hiring a full FTE. A local or chain or independent pharmacy may be looking at the market's very competitive, and they may be looking for ways to access or develop relationships with agencies because the public relations benefit is very high, and you care for a lot of highly medicated patients. We've had some small independent pharmacies in the area that have opened up competing with the chains. They're delivering to the adult homes and things like that. Those folks may be very interested in coming in and getting involved and providing some service to you. And if you are affiliated with a hospital or a health system, you should be very vocal now, especially as you consider those JCO regulation changes and things like that, to get those people. Typically, they have 24-hour pharmacy services with fairly large staffs. They should be able to provide you some resources to help you get things going. And you shouldn't always have to recreate the wheel either. They may have existing policies and procedures that you could take directly and perhaps apply to your patients in your own setting. Local systems, I would recommend that you educate yourself, check out some of these links, get familiar with the JCO regulations and the accreditation standards from different groups so that you're talking their language. I'd recommend contacting individuals at the local health systems and discuss those key quality initiatives that are important to them. Remember, you now have information that is helpful to them. They need to answer to these outside accreditation bodies, and you can help them do that. Remind them of your important relationship, that in many cases you have their highest risk patients. If they can improve those patient outcomes, they can make their whole institution look much better. You have access to data that they cannot get any other way. Your TIFs or your transfers are their admissions, and your resumption of care patients are their discharges. You guys should be able to work out a relationship, and they should be willing to work with you to share that information to help you get better. And stress that you can help them meet their goals while at the same time you are trying to meet your own. Perhaps offer something up front as far as a contribution to their initiatives, a nurse that can sit on one of the committees or a therapist of some sort to get the to kind of grease the wheels of collaboration by putting something forward, even if it's a minimal commitment.
The other thing that we think you can do on a client level or a therapeutic level by Tuesday is sitting down and looking at your populations and targeting some high-risk medication problems. These are our suggestions, therapeutic duplication, because we know that it's the low-hanging fruit, as mentioned on the next slide. Warfarin is one of the very high-risk medications, and a client can be on one medication, warfarin, and could really run into some problems. So that would be a particular one to possibly look at. Just maybe taking the group of warfarin patients in a team or with one staff person and taking a look at them, trying to prevent problems. And then linking symptoms, signs and symptoms like fall, confusion, dizziness with certain medications, as we mentioned before. So the recommendation here is not necessarily that you target these particular high-risk problems, but that you take a look at your population. As I mentioned before several times, therapeutic duplication is the low-hanging fruit. It has a high yield, and if you do have any kind of computerized risk assessment screening possibilities, this is something that can really be effectively identified with a computerized program. Next slide, Darren. The other thing that we can recommend, and maybe this can't happen by Tuesday, but maybe it can happen next month by Tuesday, is that we know that there can be challenges in computerizing risk assessment screening, but it can work and it can be a very cost-effective tool. Maybe some of your agencies already have some computerized programming that you're using, or some of you might be looking at implementing this in your agency. We did do work with one of our technical assistance sites in West Virginia, and they were very effective in computerizing the risk assessment algorithm that you can find at our website, www.homeeds.org. And they were able to tie the programming in with OASIS, particular OASIS moot points. And that was a very effective tool that now identifies at-risk clients so that when their consultant pharmacist comes in, he can really just focus on those high-risk problems and patients. And it makes a very effective use of the computer as well as the consultant services. So our website, this is a plug for our program, does have more information about our home health experience, and you can find it in the home health section under toolkit. The next slide will show you just a sample of what a screening tool can look like for a client or patient, Joe Management, and it alerts the fact that this person has a risk of recent falls, and it shows that he's on a sleeping medication, temazepam, 30 milligrams tablets. And so that would alert the nurse or the social worker that this person is at risk for a medication-related problem, and then they can follow the protocol to help manage that patient. Darren, do you want to add anything in? Because we're at the last slide, which was what the participants in our program talked about, the pharmacists, and how it helped with their medication management.
The only other point that came to mind for me was the fact that I didn't mention it before. I was talking about the preventable adverse drug events and the idea of focusing on one group of drugs. In those, in that study of the 30,000 patients, the Medicare patients from New England, the preventable adverse drug events that were serious, two-thirds of them were contributed or caused directly by cardiovascular medications. So if you want to pick an area, Coumadin or cardiovascular drugs would be a very good area to focus in on.
Yes, that's another very good one.
So at this point, we're kind of close to the end. Just to summarize, that we recommend you consult your home health care team from your QIO for more guidance and some more technical assistance, and we're going to continue, I know, here at iPro to try and develop additional resources to make available to you. We want to make sure you review your agency rate for oral medication management quality measures on agency risk-adjusted OBQI reports. Start paying attention to those reports and to visit the web page for the QIO, the MedQuick website, for additional tools and resources for this indicator. At this point, are there any other questions from the field regarding absolutely anything?
And once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question at this time. Star one on your telephone keypad. And we'll go first to Annette Grant, Split Rock. Please go ahead.
Yes, I'm just calling to ask about the question I think you did touch on, but you know, we often see and wonder about this now with this Medicare D that we're all dealing with. When the patients are assigned with the company that now is they're using, are they more limited now to staying with the one pharmacy? Because we all know that we've had them bouncing around in the past from one to another, and you don't have a full handle on what they're completely taking. Do you know that? Are they limited then in with the new company they may be assigned to through Medicare D with staying with the one pharmacy?
No, I don't believe. As long as the pharmacy can handle the claims, they will be able to go to the multiple pharmacies, is my understanding. So it's the contract they're developing is with an individual health insurance plan that offers that drug benefit. It shouldn't affect the pharmacy they go to, really, because probably the vast majority of the pharmacies are going to be able to handle the different claims for the different health plans in the state.
the other question that we had was, you know, when a pharmacy has a script there and it says 5 refills, and then the patient goes into the hospital, and that specific hospital does not use Vasatip, they use the Monopril or whatever, and they come out now with a new script for Monopril, which they take to a pharmacy or maybe another pharmacy even, and then they go ahead and get a refill on the original that's still a refill sitting at a pharmacy. Is there anything that is being considered as a way of a cross-reference or anything to prevent these kind of things, where they then wind up with 2 blood pressure medicines?
What you're referring to is that term of medication reconciliation.
Right.
I know that the hospitals are struggling with this right now all over the country. So that talking to the hospitals, they are trying to know the hospitals we've worked with locally. They are actually having pharmacists go to the floors now and are doing much more of what they call medication reconciliation. They're trying to get their computer program to identify patients who are switching, who they have switched, so they know when a patient's going out the door who has been switched to their formulary drugs. But we're still in the infancy, I think.
Right. Well, it's a hard thing to do, I guess, but I think you're mentioning about our role in keeping the hospital appraised of what we see actually in the home as the meds that the patient is taking is so important. But I'm also asking, if we did share that information, how are we protected with HIPAA?
Yeah. Oh, with HIPAA, if you are both involved in the care of the patient, HIPAA shouldn't get in the way at all.
Yes, yeah. You should be able to show that. And then on your end, any time the client or patient goes into the hospital or out of the hospital, there should be an additional medication reconciliation in the home again, because that's where there will be potential duplication, where they'll have the drug that they were taking before hospital that might be very similar to the one that they come out of the hospital with again.
I think we all, you know, experience, even if we're calling about a patient we've taken care of for 3 years who is now hospitalized and we call to find out, you know, what's happening, we do have a hard time with HIPAA and everything getting that information. Not in all instances, but in most, you know. So, well, I thank you so much. This has been extremely helpful. I'm Kathy Meyer, also at Split Rock Net, and our staff came up with these questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much.
And we'll go next to Carol Ann Thomas, St. Peter's Hospital. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Annette Tuffy from St. Peter's Home Care in Albany. In our home care agency, when we do a medication reconciliation, we're always running into the problem that we have multiple prescribers, and the physician that is writing the orders for the plan of care is not the one that you need to approach for the reconciliation orders. Have you come across that in either of your pilot studies?
Yes, we came across that a lot. What we've done is to send the list, which possibly you do also, but we send the list to all the prescribers and have had prescribers call us back, you know, like the specialist will call us back. We do try to share as much information with each of the prescribers as we can, and then try to, that's where I think the patient and caregiver advocacy comes in, is to let them know that with all these multiple prescribers, how important it is that they take a list of medicines to each visit. Sometimes we try to encourage them to take all of their medications, but they don't always do that. But at least take a list to any visit to show each of the prescribers what they're taking and to have them sign off on it.
I've had patients in the area who have exactly that happen, and I believe one of them may have been from St. Peter's Hospital, and it was exactly that scenario. The specialist may have seen the patient in the hospital, or a physician saw them in the hospital. The primary physician had not yet seen them. They didn't have another scheduled appointment for several weeks, and it came down to a point where the medications were so confused at the home that the only solution really was to recommend that they get in sooner to see the physician.
Right, the
communication system isn't there yet, but the agency has all the information. You know what medications are there. You may have a list of orders. You know what the patient is doing. And if they don't jive, sometimes the only answer is then somebody see them. Someone's got to take responsibility at some point. And one of the physicians at some point, I guess, needs in that situation to be pressured to take a stand. But I've been in those situations where no one wants to take responsibility on the multiple physicians in the community. But at the patient level, somebody's got to step up and say, maybe the next best thing is to get them in sooner and evaluate them.
Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Janet Glenn, Saratoga County Public Health. Please go ahead. Your line is open. Please check your mute function.
Hi, this is Cheryl from Saratoga. Darren, you were here before and gave us the same kind of information.
I hope it's gotten better since then.
Much better.
Huh.
My question is more on responsibility. Like, we have a couple of patients who clearly are not able to manage their medications at home. They are constantly taking the wrong medicines or overdoses and stuff. We've documented this to the doctor. We've documented everything we can do, and yet the doctors are not willing or agreeable to decrease or stop the meds.
Mm-hmm.
Where can we go from there, or can't we? There's no family involved. The patients are living home alone, and they're at high risk.
Do you have a medical director for your agency?
Yeah.
In those cases, when we've run into some of the patients where we've actually had to say they're not answering us, they're not responding appropriately, we'll actually take things to the medical director and ask them to interact at that level. And if that doesn't work, then the agency may actually have to make a decision as to whether they can care for that patient. But I think the medical director is the next step if you haven't pursued that yet.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, and that's what we've done, too. We've used our medical director talking physician to physician. And if at all possible, to advocate with the patient sometimes to see about a different physician. I don't know if that is a possibility.
And we'll take our next question from Lori Fitzgerald, Visiting Nurse Services. Please go ahead.
Hello. My question is similar to the girl from St. Peter's, and it relates to the fact that in this area there are several physician groups that use hospitalists.
Oh, yes.
And somebody goes into the hospital, and then it's the same situation. They may do a reconciliation before they come out, but if there's questions, the primary hasn't seen them yet, and the hospitalist will not deal with them once they're out of the hospital. And so my question is, are you aware of what kinds of responsibilities the hospitalist and the primary physician have in speaking to each other before somebody comes out of the hospital to address those situations?
Denny, did you have anything? I can jump in if you'd like.
I know that this question came up recently as well about the hospitalists, and her question is about their responsibilities, so I don't...
Yeah, well, we actually here, in working with the Eddie Visiting Nurses, because they're part of Northeast Health, which does employ hospitalists, my understanding with them is that the hospitalists are taking on a larger and larger percentage of their hospital admissions, so the agencies are probably behooved to go talk to those hospitalist groups. What we actually did a few months ago was got together a group of the medical directors from the hospital, along with some of the hospitalists, along with some of the primary care physicians from the community, and actually sat down and hashed out where some of the breaks are in the line of communications. And there's definitely a gap. There's that couple weeks when the patient comes out of the hospital where they're almost in no man's land.
Right.
And we did it. We haven't finished up following up on that yet, but the things that were discussed were things along the lines of speeding up medical transcription in some way so that the primary care offices get those reports sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the hospitals can do automated, dictated discharge notes, but they only do them on some of the patients, not all of them. Well, if we find it's a problem, if you think all your home care patients are high risk, you might be able to talk to the institution about perhaps accelerating that communication process, maybe come to some understanding with the hospitalist group about how orders are going to be clarified once patients come out of the hospital. If they write an order for a statin and it's not the one the patient is taking in the home, I find it hard to believe that they don't bear some responsibility for clarifying those orders. But I think communication is the thing. And if you can get the administrator from the hospital who has to answer to the JACO people about medication reconciliation, that's the individual who's also managing the contract with those hospitalists, and that's the person who could sit them down together and say, how can we work this out? I think everyone agrees. The talks we had were very good. We can identify where the problems are, and I think getting everyone around the table for a specific purpose, whether it's JACO regs and meeting those standards or whatever, having the discussion, and I think there will be opportunities for improving that communication.
Thank you.
And, Lori, this is Sarah. There are some agencies that have had some success using a fax form
The orders that are obtained from the hospital is prior to the patient even leaving the hospital, before and at the time the referral is taken, is sent directly to the primary care physician before the patient even leaves the hospital. It's over to them. And they have to inspect it and sign off on it, and that's faxed back to the agency. So we've had some agencies have success with using that so that it's, there's some reconciliation even before the patient leaves.
Okay.
That's good.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Elizabeth Salveson, Patients of Westchester. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, that's PTS of Westchester. Is there a list available of those meds that are considered to be at risk for therapeutic duplication?
Yes, on our website there is an algorithm, and it lists, I believe it lists the more common therapeutic duplications. Our software vendor also was, we were able to work with them to set up a list of like cardiac medications, you know, blood pressure medications, pain medications within categories. So if you need more information about that, you could maybe contact me directly. You could look at our website first, and then if you need additional information, I can help you out with that.
Well, thank you very much.
And we have a follow-up question from Catherine Curtis, Noble Visiting Nurse. Please go ahead.
Actually, you covered it. It was about responsibility, communication, cost, and all that stuff. So thank you.
Okay, good.
And at this time, we have no further questions. I would like to turn the conference back over to the speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
Sure, I want to apologize to the folks from St. Peter's because I didn't want to imply or infer in any way that the discharge problem is got anything to do with their hospital. And actually, I wanted to highlight that they actually did recently hire a pharmacist, I believe, on the inpatient side, an actual FTE, to do med reconciliation. So I think as a closing point, I just stress that the hospitals themselves are in an environment now where they have to demonstrate that they can do a better job with these things. So I'd strongly recommend that you agencies get in touch with the institutions that refer a lot of your patients and start talking their language on how you can help one another. Denny, anything from you on the way out?
No, I just want to thank everybody for their attention and their questions. They were really good questions. And if anybody needs additional information, particularly if you have waiver clients, I'm happy to be contacted by email or through the website.
Okay. And I'd like to thank Dr. Triller and Dr. Fry for their expertise in sharing their information this afternoon. I'm sorry we went a little bit over, but I think that as Dr. Frey said, the questions were excellent, and I hope that everybody got a lot out of the presentation. We did provide you with evaluations when you registered for today's call, so we do appreciate you filling out evaluations and sending them back to us. And again, please feel free to contact your quality improvement organization, home health team, to follow through on some of the ideas that have been presented today so we can all move forward to try and improve the measure. And thank you all for participating.
That does conclude today's presentation. We thank you for your participation, and you may disconnect at this time.